It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to an expert who questions the benefits of First Lady Michelle Obama's message to drink more water.
But first, we're continuing our conversation about food policy in the United States. We just talked about some of the issues, and now we'll talk about some of the solutions. Our guest is Marion Nestle. She's the author of Eat, Drink, Vote, an illustrated guide to food politics.
And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you could change one thing about how we get our food, about laws on food in this country, what would it be? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, Marion, I want to talk about some of the solutions to what we've been describing so far. Obviously, there's a lot of territory here, but if you're going to give consumers a guide to help, you know, fix things, set things right and make themselves and their families healthier, what would you advise?
Well, the advice about healthy eating is really pretty simple. It's eat more fruits and vegetables and don't eat too much junk food. I mean, it really isn't any more complicated than that. You have to balance calories, too. And the best way to do that is to weigh yourself on a scale. There really isn't any other way to do that. If weight is going up, then you're eating more than you should. This isn't rocket science. What makes it so complicated and what makes all the complicated messages so confusing to people are all of the vested interests in all of this. Anytime you say don't eat too much junk food, people who make junk food don't like it.
And what about consumers? I mean, how do we feel about it when we hear that, don't eat junk food? I mean, I think everybody knows that.
No, it's not don't eat junk food. It's not don't eat too much junk food. You know, I mean, there's a real difference, and I think that's what there are lots of things about nutrition that I think make it a particularly difficult science, if you want to put it that way. Everybody eats, so everybody has an opinion, and everyone has a lot of personal experience with food and with whether food makes them feel good, bad, or indifferent. And then there are the marketing messages, and food companies spend probably a total of close to $30 or $40 billion a year on marketing their products. And most of us think that food marketing has no effect on our choices at all. But research shows otherwise. It really does have an effect. And it has an effect that we're not aware of, and we're not supposed to be aware of it. If it's really good marketing, it slips below any kind of radar of critical thinking. So that makes it difficult. You don't make food choices in a vacuum. You make food choices depending on what's available, what your friends are eating, and what you can afford, and what you like.
So, Marion, if you were queen, would you support a motion from Congress that made it harder for marketers to, you know, to use the fancy techniques that they use to market food to people?
Oh, unquestionably. I would put enormous restrictions on food marketing, especially to children, because there's so much evidence that shows that kids who are not marketed to eat more healthfully. More and more evidence is coming out all the time on that. Excuse me. So that would certainly be something I would do. I would also change the farm bill so that it promotes fruits and vegetables and makes it easier for people to buy fruits and vegetables at a lower cost. I mean, I think there are lots of policy changes that the government could do that would make it much, much easier for people to eat more healthfully.
What about things like, you know, banning ingredients, trans fats, for instance, or giant sodas?
Well, trans fats were a no-brainer. I mean, really, they were. They were artificial. They make no difference. There are lots of substitutes. That was not an anti-obesity intervention. That was a heart disease intervention. And there are lots of substitutes that don't cost any different. It really was so easy to do that in the places where it's been banned, nobody really noticed. That was an easy one. I think the soda cap, which was not a ban, by the way, it was a cap on this is Mayor Bloomberg's 16-ounce soda cap. The idea was to make a smaller soda size be the default, and the size that he picked was 16 ounces, which is two standard servings. And the notion was that if people got a 16-ounce soda, that would, for most people, that would really be enough. And anybody who wanted to order more could. You know, sodas didn't used to be this big.
Mm-hmm.
That's a relatively new innovation.
I wonder if you're optimistic about our chances for making some of these improvements that you're talking about. I look at the success of Michael Pollan, who's gotten a lot of traction with his message, which is very similar to what you're saying here. You know, just eat more fruits and vegetables, eat real food, don't eat too much of it.
Yeah, don't eat anything your grandmother wouldn't recognize.
Right. Do you think that message is getting somewhere in America?
Well, it's certainly getting to young people. I mean, I teach at a university, and so I'm dealing with young people all the time, and I'm enormously heartened by their interest in food, their excitement about it, their wanting to create a food system that's healthier for people and the planet. And in a sense, I wrote this book, or put together this book, I guess is a better way of putting it, to try to reach a larger audience and hopefully of young people.
We've got a comment here from Natalie in Waukesha who called to say, it's hard to compare product nutrition on foods that have portion sizes on the label. Cereal, for example. I try to read labels, but it's hard to make fair comparisons when trying to figure out nutritional content of the food. It involves a lot of math. Is that something you look at, that we should simplify the labels?
Yeah, it certainly does. The FDA is working on proposals to simplify the label. I think it badly needs doing. And the caller has picked on the most serious issue with food labels, which is the portion size problem. Especially with cereals, where cereal makers are allowed to decide what the portion size is, and they're very, very different, and they have lots of different tiny fractions. So without your calculator sitting right there, it's pretty hard to figure it out. I mean, this is another place where the government could intervene and make something much easier for people, so people could make healthful choices much easier.
Do you think it's important that consumers, when possible, try to pick organic foods over, you know, foods that have been grown with pesticides and other chemicals?
Well, I'm a big proponent of organics because I think there's a real attempt in the organic standards to reduce the use of pesticides and harmful chemicals that are used in food production, and also to replenish the soil and other kinds of requirements that make it much, much better from an environmental perspective. So I'm in favor of it that way. Here again, there's something that the government could do to make the cost of organic food more accessible to people who can't afford it.
So anything else you're going to do to get your message out to young people, as you say, your target audience?
Well, I write a blog. I write an almost daily blog that's open to everybody and that I hope lots and lots of people will use. I try to link to the original documents that are related to an issue I'm going to post about Michelle Obama's water initiative tomorrow, and I'll try to link to all of the relative documents around that. So if anybody's interested in it, they can go to one place and find out everything they need to know very quickly.
And what's the address for that?
That's foodpolitics.com.
Okay, great. Well, Marion, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
I've been talking to Marion Nessel, the author of Eat, Drink, Vote, an illustrated guide to food politics. She's a professor at New York University.
Coming up, a related issue. We'll talk about First Lady Michelle Obama's message during her visit in Wisconsin today. You just heard about that. Drink more water. Will this actually help people? Our next guest has his doubts.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. Later in the hour, we're going to speak with a scientist who's trying to design video games that help kids learn mindfulness.
First Lady Michelle Obama made a special visit to Wisconsin today to launch her new campaign to encourage Americans to drink more water.
Her campaign is called Drink Up, and she spoke to more than 1,500 students at Watertown High School this afternoon about the benefits of water.
Here with us to weigh in on the First Lady's push for more water is Dr. Stanley Goldfarb. He's a professor of medicine at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Stanley, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much.
So Michelle Obama said, I've come to realize that if we were going to take just one step to make ourselves and our families healthier, probably the single best thing we could do is simply drink more water. Well, do you agree with that?
I don't, frankly. I don't know that drinking water per se actually has been shown in any important, clear-cut scientific studies to improve health. It is a complicated topic, though, and I think, sort of reading between the lines of Mrs. Obama's efforts, what really is going on here is an attempt to substitute the drinking of water for the drinking of other substances such as sodas and fruit juices that tend to have a high caloric content and tend to contribute to the problem of obesity. I'm not sure why that wasn't explicitly stated as part of the campaign. I suspect maybe it had to do with the flap in New York City over Mayor Bloomberg trying to ban sodas of a certain size. I think in that sense, drinking water instead of drinking soda, I understand the rationale for that. But the evidence that purposefully increasing your water intake will have health benefits is extraordinarily thin. There are a few studies that have been conducted in large populations that hint that it might be beneficial, but they don't reach the level where I think one would make recommendations to numbers of patients that this would actually promote health.
Well, one of the common bits of wisdom we hear from one another, I think, is drink 8 glasses of water every day. That's the key to good health. Is that true? And if not, where did that come from?
Well, a scientist named Heinz Valton, who's a very respected renal physiologist at Dartmouth Medical School, wrote an article in a prestigious scientific journal asking that question. He decided that it probably came from the fact that we take in about that much water a day in as various liquids, and that somehow that transferred from being an average to being a specific recommendation. And we take in that much water because there's a certain obligatory amount of water that we need to take in through our diet. Depending on what our diet is like, we're going to need a certain amount of water because the breakdown products of our diet tend to promote the excretion of products in the urine that obligate water to follow them. So that's the biggest source of our need for water, and then we lose water through our skin each day through evaporation, again, depending on the temperature or the hard work that we happen to be doing. So it's an average of what people need because of the demands of diet and metabolism, and rather than a number that tends to promote any particular good health outcome.
Well, let me take you to a battlefield in the water wars, my breakfast table. I, Dad, say, kids, drink water. Kids respond, but we're not thirsty. Who's right?
The kids.
I suspected that. Why?
Because, you know, we're designed, our bodies are designed to maintain a water balance. We're designed to maintain a certain amount of fluid in our body. And the viewers should remember that our bodies, if you weighed 100 pounds, 60 pounds of that 100 pounds is water. We have a huge storehouse of water in our body. It's crucial for all the chemical reactions and the biochemical reactions that go on in our body each day. It's crucial for normal heart functioning and et cetera, nerve functioning. And it's not surprising to realize that we would have a mechanism that is built into the system to guarantee that we know when we're water deficient, and that mechanism is thirst. So when we're thirsty, that means we have had a loss of water from our body, and we have the need to replenish it. Our body actually is sensitive to even a smaller amount of water loss and starts to conserve water by reducing urine output even before we become thirsty. So thirst is a very good index of somebody having a measurable decline in the amount of water in their body. Now, that decline that is induced by thirst is very small and is even within the range of normal variation, but it's a very powerful system. So, I mean, just imagine every animal, that's on Earth or that is in a terrestrial environment needs to know when they need to replenish and replace any water that's been lost. And we're included in that animal kingdom. So there's a very sensitive mechanism, and children certainly have it. So I've talked to pediatricians about this issue, and they don't recommend that you force fluids on children, that they'll drink when they're thirsty.
Well, I want to quote noted health expert, football coach, and commentator John Madden. And anytime there was a game in hot weather, he'd say, by the time the football players are thirsty, it's too late. So they're already going to feel the consequences of dehydration. What about if we're in some sort of highly sure. dehydrating activity like football or construction work in the sun or something like that? Do we need to load up on water first?
Let's take soldiers. Let's take the military because this has been studied very carefully. Consider a soldier that's out on patrol in Afghanistan carrying 60 pounds of equipment with him or her. And they're going to be out on patrol in some hostile environment. They need to have adequate water. And the amount of water that they're going to need is, in fact, going to be a function of the amount of energy that they have to expend and the temperature in the environment. So one needs to prepare for that. And part of their 60 pounds of equipment that they're taking is enough water to sustain them for whatever period their patrol is going to require. And this is something that's very well been worked out by the military. And what Coach Madden suggests is not entirely wrong. I don't know that it's too late. I mean, when the football players are thirsty, they'll go to the sideline and drink. And I think it makes a lot of sense to have fluids available. But when you see them on the sideline drinking, they're thirsty because they've just had some sweating and they've started to get dehydrated. And you don't see them continuously drinking fluids throughout the day. Now, if a coach decides to do that, that's fine. But there have been careful studies of overhydrating athletes to see whether that would improve their performance. And there's no evidence that overhydrating, so for example, drinking lots of water before you begin a particular exercise like intense running, doesn't lead you to run further than if you didn't overhydrate yourself prior to that. So I think it's good practice to have lots of water available. And if a player wants to drink extra water during the game, that's fine. I certainly agree with Coach Madden that if you allow a player to become substantially dehydrated, that will impair performance, and that could potentially be dangerous. But again, our thirst mechanisms, when they start to kick in, the amount of dehydration that's occurred is quite minimal. However, if someone's going to exercise very intensely, it's not going to be long after thirst is stimulated that they're then potentially going to become significantly dehydrated. So that's the logic for drinking when even prior to thirst, during a situation such as the football player on a hot night or a soldier in a very difficult environment.
Well, let's get into the idea you mentioned earlier that maybe the subtext of the First Lady's push to drink more water is drink more water, parentheses, instead of soda. If kids have more water available, if they think of water first, isn't that going to have a health benefit if they're not drinking soda?
Well, it'll have the benefit of reducing their caloric intake. So to the extent that that's required, particularly in an obese child or adult, certainly. And I think the evidence is quite clear that that's, in fact, the case. The thing that was a little distressing was that's not what was indicated. She, as you've said, she made this statement about, in fact, water itself, unrelated to what else you're drinking, is going to be particularly beneficial. And that's where I think, one wonders the scientific basis for that statement, because I'm unaware of the science that underlies that. And this is an area that I've been very interested in over the years.
I don't know if you want to venture into the politics of it, but do you think that maybe it's she wants to encourage the water and not explicitly say bad things about an industry that makes money and maybe makes donations to politicians?
I don't know what the politics are. I do know that apparently the companies that make water and the companies that make soda are also companies that make water and bottled water. So I can't really speak to the economics of all this. But I would say that there is an economic interest at stake here. And one always needs to sort through that when one tries to understand the recommendations. But I do believe that this was, a good faith recommendation, more to do with reducing caloric intake than trying to make a case for something in which the science really doesn't support. The case being made for reducing caloric intake is a very solid scientific case. The case being made for overhydrating individuals to accomplish some particular outcome there's very little evidence that that case can be made.
We're talking about the First Lady, Michelle Obama's visit to Watertown, Wisconsin today. She's making the case that we need to drink more water, and maybe the subtext is drink less soda. Stanley Goldfarb is with us. He's a professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania.
And we'd love to hear from you. What, do you make a conscious effort to drink more water? Have you ever consciously increased the amount of water you drink as part of a diet? And how did you feel? How do you feel about Michelle Obama's move to urge people to drink, you know, at least a glass more water a day? Is it worthwhile? Will it accomplish anything? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about water and other beverages, how much we should drink, what we should drink. First Lady Michelle Obama is in Wisconsin today trying to get us to drink more water.
And we'd love to hear from you. What do you think about Michelle Obama's push to get people to drink more water? And do you think that it will get kids drinking fewer sugary drinks? How can we get kids to lean less on the juice and the soda and to down more water? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Stanley Goldfarb is our guest professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. The story so far, he says, if the goal is just to get people, kids, to drink more water, there's not a lot of proven health benefit, but there is benefit for to drink less soda, less sugary beverage. Stanley, let's follow that theme. How big a problem is soda, is the consumption of sugary beverages, especially by kids?
Oh, I can't really speak to that. I'm not an expert on childhood obesity. I think there's certainly many studies that have shown conclusively that switching over from soda to water will reduce caloric intake. So I think there's good rationale for that. I'm aware of studies in adults. I'm not aware of particular studies in children. But clearly, if one actually reduces a caloric intake by reducing sugary beverages, then it's quite clear that that water can be an effective substitute.
Here's a question from Jerry in Central Wisconsin, wrote in, said, can you talk about diuretics, things like energy drinks, Mountain Dew, and coffee? He says, these things put us in a state of dehydration. Should we drink more water if we're consuming these kind of things?
You know, that's a bit of a myth. There have been a few studies of that, and the suggestion is actually that they don't really produce much in the way of a negative water balance, and what that means is more out than is actually consumed. So they may stimulate urination a bit more quickly than pure water, because they do have effects on smooth muscle that controls the urge to urinate and all. But in fact, when people have done careful studies of the amount of fluid that comes out compared to the amount of fluid that goes in with coffee in particular, the effect of dehydrating is quite minimal. So coffee counts as in the total amount of fluid that you take in each day, and generally won't produce substantial dehydration at all.
With those energy drinks, at least according to the marketing, they will hydrate us better for our active athletic lifestyle. Is there anything to that, or is water just as good?
Well, certainly these drinks, these sports drinks, do attempt to mimic the composition of sweat. But in addition, many of them contained large amounts of sugar as well. So they tend to give calories. Now, obviously, if someone is extremely active, then their need for extra calories will be there, and so they won't be gaining weight if they drink sugary sports drinks. Are they better in terms of producing a particular outcome? It depends on the individual. It depends how well-trained they are. It depends how much sweating they do. A well-trained individual who's a superior athlete will tend to lose less in the way of salts through their sweat than someone who's untrained. So an untrained individual might benefit more from those kinds of drinks to replace whatever losses they have during intense exercise. But, you know, eating a regular diet and drinking until you quench your thirst after exercise would accomplish the same goal.
We'll go to the phones now. We have Mark with us in Kenosha. Mark, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Another benefit of water that my dentist pointed out to me was, which I didn't realize, is that the soda I was drinking was taking the enamel off of my teeth. He had strategically placed a bottle of a product called Water Joe in front of me so that I would ask about it. He said, you know, most of the people are drinking soda, like, are non-coffee drinkers, and they like the caffeine. You can switch to this particular product. I tried to do a commercial for them, but where you're drinking a glass of water, and the only other thing they had in is enough caffeine for a cup of coffee. But that's a huge problem. They even call have a name for it. A woman in my office, her husband's a dentist, said they call it hillbilly mouth. You know, the teeth are rotten, like a meth addict in some cases.
Just because of soda consumption. So a benefit to drinking water, well, not so much drinking water as not drinking soda again, as with obesity, that's the dental benefit, it sounds like, Stanley.
One of the things, too, I don't know if other people have this, but once you get kind of the habit of drinking soda, I'm kind of a big consumer of it. I'll drink 6-7 sodas a day. And when I try to stop doing that, it's like, it's hard to stop cold turkey. If you
gotcha.
Have water with you, kind of have that oral fixation type of thing. It's a great thing to switch from.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call, Mark. And Stanley, again, it sounds like the benefit isn't so much just from drinking more water. It's the not drinking the soda.
Yeah, I think that's correct. You know, one of the problems with drinking water, it's fine if you use the city water supply and carry your own water bottle with you, but many people buy bottled water, and now we create a new problem of waste and also expense associated with that. So that's another issue about drinking extra water that isn't really necessary. The city tap water is fine. It's clearly carefully monitored in most municipalities and quite safe.
All right, but no caffeine in the tap water as far as I know. That sounded like
correct.
A key for Mark.
Hopefully.
So a couple other water questions that I'm curious about. Is there a point where, and what is that point, when we drink too much water, and what can the effects be?
There are circumstances where drinking too much is a problem. Probably the most dramatic one that occurs commonly are people that are participating in marathons, and there are water stations along the way, and they drink, if they're not very good runners and take a long time to complete the marathon, there have been many cases of people becoming overhydrated, having a fall in their serum sodium concentration, which leads to some swelling of the brain, and which actually ends up putting them in the hospital. So, in fact, more people are injured in marathons from drinking too much water than drinking too little. And organizers of marathons are well aware of this, and now they have very strict guidelines and recommendations how much water to drink during races, which really represents quite minimal amounts of water. There have been some very tragic situations where there was a radio contest years ago with a young woman who was asked to drink, a gallon or two of water over a very short period of time and actually produced this episode of brain swelling and died. Another problem with too much drinking water is actually associated with a drug use, which is ecstasy. Ecstasy is associated with some people having an intense thirst associated with it as one of its side effects, and there have been many cases of severe overhydration, too much water drinking, with really tragic, even death associated with it because of, again, this brain swelling problem. Now, this represents drinking quarts and quarts of water over a very, very short interval, you know, less than an hour. But somebody who's just drinking water throughout the day, sipping water at a meal or in between meals and doesn't have any other health problems, all that's going to do is make them urinate more frequently. It won't produce any real dangerous situations, but that assumes that they have no other health problems.
All right. When it comes to water, can you leave us with your recommendations? How much should we drink? When should we drink water?
We should drink water whenever we're thirsty.
All right. Well, Stanley Goldfarb, thanks a lot. Appreciate you shedding some light on the issue.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was Stanley Goldfarb, professor of medicine at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. And I got to say, there's some kind of psychosomatic element because me and Veronica and our board operator, Michelle Good, at various points, we're all reaching for our water. I think just talking about thirst keeps making us thirsty here.
All right. Well, now we'll check the headlines, drink some more water, and then we'll hear from a Wisconsin scientist who's looking to video games to help kids learn things like focus, empathy, and self-control. Rob is drinking.
Sorry. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. There's a growing body of research that suggests the practice of meditation can help the brain develop focus, self-control, and empathy.
Now a team of researchers at the UW-Madison is developing two video games to see if kids who play them can develop the same benefits that meditation brings. And joining us now to talk about that effort is Lisa Fluke. She's an assistant scientist at the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds in Madison. Lisa, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
Well, Richard Davidson, who heads the Center for the Investigation of Healthy Minds, compared most video gaming experiences to being in a rudderless boat. What do you think he means by that?
With the video games, that there isn't necessarily a purpose for them beyond entertainment value, and that in contrast to some of the games that are being developed in collaboration with the Games Learning Society, which are really developed with the intention of developing skills and being beneficial.
Well, tell us a bit about who's working on the two mindfulness video games that you're researching right now.
Sure. So the video games are developed for middle school students, and these are 7th and 8th graders. And there's two video games. One is focused on breath awareness activity, and it's based on a prototype that a graduate student from the lab developed and involves basically being aware of breathing and then giving input into an iPad system based on the number of inhalations and exhalations. And throughout this game, as the player goes on, their scenery that they're playing through, they can walk through ancient ruins or through outer space, and the visual scenery becomes more populated as the player goes through the game and can earn achievements.
And so is it based on how mindful they are of their own breaths and things like that?
Right. It assesses their accuracy because they have to keep count. And then when they're off count, then they get an error kind of feedback message.
So at first when you were describing that, I thought, okay, they have to count their breaths. It doesn't sound very fun. But then when you got to the walking through ancient ruins, I can see that, you know, it would be kind of exciting to tie your breath to getting deeper and deeper into the game and getting to see more and more interesting things.
Yeah, that's the really cool thing about working with this group, that they develop these games that really look like games that you might get off the shelf and that are fun to play and that are engaging, but yet that they can have this, potentially this extra benefit that we're looking at through the research.
Was that the part of the challenge of doing this? You know, that's, you know, as far as video games go, usually what the video game is striving for is a lot of action, edge of your seat stuff. It often involves driving something really fast or shooting something. And in this case, you're talking about a different, a video game that's exciting to play, that the children want to play, but that is also, you know, something different, something more constructive.
Yeah, and that it could still be engaging, but not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily have all the action and chaos and violence going on in it, but that there's ways that just by being more in tune with what's going on inside of them, that can actually potentially bring about some calm even.
And the other game is called, as I understand it, Crystals of Kador, is it? Can you tell us about that one?
Sure, and that was a game that it's a situation where they take on the role of a robot that's dropped into an alien planet. And then there's different scenarios that they go through where they meet different alien creatures. And in order to get through the game and to recover their missing parts that in their crash landing, they need to be able to discern the emotions of the different aliens and then interact with them in helpful ways. And so it gives them an opportunity to practice recognizing others' emotions and responding to others who might be in need of help.
So if the game is working the way that you're hoping it's working, what will someone who's playing Crystals of Kador come away with? What will they be working on to develop in their brains?
So there's a possibility that it could cultivate greater empathy and activate those kinds of the circuitry that's involved in empathic responding and pro-social behavior.
And what kind of results have go ahead.
And so as part of the research, the participants come in to the laboratory on three different occasions, and they are involved in a variety of assessments that include brain scans before and after, and they do computer activities, and they also respond to questionnaires so we can look at what's happening in these participants as they play. And so these are the two games that were developed specifically for the study. And there are another two games that are used to contrast with the two that were developed, so that there's one of four games that a participant is assigned to, and we look and compare across these conditions what's happening to a student, a teenager, as they're playing these games. And they play them for about 2 weeks for 20 to 30 minutes a day.
And so what kind of results have you gotten back so far?
We're right in the middle of recruiting and running participants right now. So if there are people who are interested in participating, if you know a 7th or 8th grade student in the Madison area who would like to do this, they also have a chance, because the game is played on an iPad, to, you know, use an iPad for a couple of weeks and then they get entered into a drawing to possibly win one. And so they can go to our recruitment website, which is go.wisc.edu/games, and there's information about how to enroll and find out more.
Okay, that's maybe you should say it again. Say it one more time, please.
Sure. go.wisc.edu/games. And it sounds like there might be a link on your website to it as well.
Great. Yes, this is up on our Facebook page, so we don't need to rely on my poor rendering of that address. And I understand we've got someone on Facebook, Marcia, who says she will be going to Games and Learning Society tonight and as an educator. She's going to be previewing these games. So you've got educators in on this too.
Right. I mean, that's terrific. And so the idea is that the children or the students are playing them outside of school, so at home when they might otherwise be engaging in, like, you know, whatever usual activity or media they're doing. And so they're doing it outside of school, but that they could have potential educational benefits.
In terms of, you know, what's most efficacious for kids and what really works in kids' brains, I mean, is it easier to get them to play a video game and that it's harder to get them to sit down and try to learn some rudimentary meditation? Is that why you're focusing on the games?
Yeah, and I don't know that necessarily they would replace other types of instruction around mindfulness, but this could be a way that someone who maybe has familiarity and is comfortable with using an iPad or a computer or whatever it might be, that if they like games and exploring and trying out new kinds of activities, then this might be something that they could relate to, and it's presented in easy format that's very accessible, whereas a student might not just off the bat decide to go to a class for 6 or 8 weeks.
Can you talk a little bit about what the value of mindfulness is for children?
Sure. This is an area, I mean, that really is just beginning. I mean, at the very beginning stages of being researched. And mindfulness, for people who may not be as familiar, is defined by Jon Kabat-Zinn as paying attention in a particular way, which is on purpose, in the present moment, and without judgment. And so the idea is that students, people can learn to be with their experience as it's coming up. It can relate in a different way to whatever experience is presenting itself. So in difficult circumstances, like being with that and not just automatically reacting or running away from the situation, but really being able to see it for what it is and then making a choice, having a chance to respond in a constructive way.
Now, you've been helping with the kindness curriculum that your center is working on as well, and working with 4K students. So can you give me an example of a real-life scenario that might happen and mindfulness might come into play?
Sure. There's actually a great example where the instructor in the class, she was right there in the classroom teaching students, and what emerged, which this was in a 4K classroom, so these are 4-year-old kindergarten students in the Madison School District. Or what happened was that one of the students grabbed a toy from another, and that upset the student, and he felt like his finger got hurt. And this is documented actually in a documentary. And then Laura is the woman who was instructing, and she saw this happen. And so she, right on the spot, brought both of the students together to talk it out and to work it out. So she asked them to notice what they were feeling in their body. One of the students was crying, and he was breathing really hard, so asking him to notice what he was feeling and then being able to say what happened. And so they could, the other student who grabbed the toy could hear what happened to this boy, and he could then respond. And just spontaneously, they processed that situation and were able to see that, oh, they both felt upset by this, and that he felt sorry that the other boy was upset and he hurt him.
So that's the empathy training that you're talking about, too.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it's possible, yeah, in the classroom setting, even with very young children, it looks like.
Is there any correlation between mindfulness training and academic achievement that you know of so far?
Well, we are looking into this actually right now. We're conducting a study that's in its second year to see what are the kinds of outcomes that are associated with this training. And one of the ones that we're particularly interested in is this quality of self-regulation that's been shown to predict academic success as well as outcomes later in life, including health and financial stability. And so we have measures of this in the study, and hopefully within the next year or so, we'll have a good idea of what the findings are looking like.
Now, it sounds like with these two video games that are in development, Tenacity and The Crystals of Kador, you're working with middle school students, and then with your kindness curriculum, which is also mindfulness-based, those are 4-year-old kindergarten students. Do you have a sense of whether there's an ideal time for a young mind to be trying to learn these techniques?
Mm-hmm. And that's a great question. And at different ages, they could be introduced in different ways. And the activities are certainly adapted from practices that are taught to adults, but they use more visuals and hands-on kinds of activities for the younger kids. And so it seems that that we're seeing in the classes where we've been, that children, who are 4 years old are quite receptive to this and even spontaneously ask to practice some of the activities when the teacher is not there in the classroom even. And they also, we've heard that they go home and they share it with their parents, too.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate you telling us about this.
Oh, happily to do it.
We've been talking to Lisa Fluke, an assistant scientist at the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds in Madison.
Coming up, we'll talk to an African-American journalist who graduated from UW-Milwaukee and now is looking at why so many of his peers today aren't graduating. That's coming up. Stick around. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.